I intended to make a shiur on the different points I heard from our Brevda, but in the end, when I looked at my sefer, I decided, instead of doing that, to read certain sections out, maybe elaborate on certain things. I don't think I could put it better than I put it in my sefer, so I'll be honest with you.
No plagiarism, please.
Yes, exactly what I was going to say.
At the Hespena for Avolba.
Plagiarism on yourself.
I remember Avolba, at the Hespena for Avolba. So, Reuven Leuchter gave a Hespen, and he said as follows, that Rav Volva once read out as a passage from Ali Shaw, and he said, this is beautiful writing, he's a man himself. And if he agrees with him, what he said is so if Rav Volva can say that, he read it, so, take a look, I'd like to read that, so look at page 82, a little bit about who he was, and...
page what, Rabbi, sorry?
Page 80, where is
40,
it?
48, no?
48, the Chabura Minyan Rebbe. Just before, words of introduction. Remember the Lashon I once brought in a shiur that Reb Elia Lapian had said in London, in the yeshiva, in Chai Olam Yeshiva, Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in London, that Reb Elchanan had come into England and said that he heard in the name of the Chofetz Chaim that there will be three wars of Gog and Magog. 1918, he said that. What has just happened now, the First World War, was called the First War of Gog and Magog. That's what the Chofetz Chaim, what happened now. He then said, in 25 years, there will be another war which will make the first one look like child's play. But this is, it says in the footnote there, in the Lev Elior, that Rabbi Zalman Meltzer ran into Reb Adin. Like, what did you mean? He said exactly what I said. The second one will make the first one look like child's play. And then he came to live in Eitz as well. He became Rosh Hashiva in Eitz Chaim, Rabbi Zalman. Then he said the third one would be an Eis Tzora LeYaakov, Umimenu Yevoshea. From there they would be saved. Umimenu Yevoshea. That's what he said. Just an Eis Tzora LeYaakov. Now, Reb Elchanan said on those words, which are beautiful words, Reb Elchanan was something like a Novi, you know, Kovitz Ma'amorim, equals to Mashiach. Reb Elchanan said about Chofetz Chaim, Rak ha-maskil be'ez hazois, only a maskil. A maskil is a thinking person, discerning person. Yidoim, keep quiet, v'yitkoinein and prepare, v'hachonos halbe, with many preparations, ula yire v'nechom atzim v'ushalayim. Maybe such a person will see. A maskil. The Gaon says in Mishle, a maskil is the meaning of successful. The beginning of Mishle, the pasuk says, Lakachach Musa Haskel, Tzedek U'Mishpat Meshorim, says the Gaon on the Pshat. Lakachach Musa Haskel means to be successful. Haskel, Leman Taskilu, to be successful. Tzedek is Ben Adam Lachaveiro, Lahatoba. Mishpat is Vigzur Be'altechato, and Meshorim to be forthright, I think Rabbi Brevda was a perfect example of being a master, extremely well thought out, and he saw things in a very clear way, very forthright manner. He had a tremendous understanding, tremendous insight into different situations. He was a Talmud, you'll see in a minute, of Rav Chatzkon, one of the first Talmudim of the Biskorov. When he said a brisk, he was told by the Biskorov to, he went to learn with Rav Yoshi Ber, where brisk started in Eretz Yisrael. But he had tremendous insight, tremendous thought into things. And you'll see, look at these, some of these passages I wrote here. An unlikely shidduch. The match between the Rav and his Talmidim would have seemed tenuous. He had recently arrived in London from Kollel Chazanish, the most eminent of Torah academies in Bnei Brak, and was renowned as one of the foremost students of the Mashgiach in the Mir Yeshiva, the Chatzko Levenstein, and later the Biskor Rav in Jerusalem. He had spent years engrossed in the writings of the Vilna Gaon and his Talmid, Rav Chaim Volozhin. Born and raised in America, and then through years spent close to these great Talmudim in Eretz Yisrael, he had never been exposed to the idiosyncrasies of English mannerisms. It's an interesting, Rabbi Yisrael. Rabbi Bevda had to leave Eretz Yisrael because of his health. He couldn't take the heat in Bnei Brak. So Rabbi Chatzko said to him, you can either go to America or you can go to England. If you go to America, you'll be an overnight success until someone else comes along and they'll push you aside. America will not be loyal to you. If you go to England, it'll take you years to have Talmudim. But they'll be very skeptical, but you'll have Talmidim from there. That's what he said to him. He came to England. He came to England in the end.
Didn't he mention Australia?
No, he didn't mention Australia. But interesting that how Rav Chatzko saw America. Until someone else comes along and pushes you away. In England, they won't accept you. When they do accept you, then they'll have Talmidim. He had a very strong Chabura of people in the Sunday night. He used to give a shiur about 50, 60 people. in a house in Golders Green, and he had a full olam there for 2 hours at least. I lived at the time in Birmingham. I used to come down from Birmingham to London. I drove down on Sunday evening to listen to the Shia in Birmingham. In London, I came down to listen to the Shia. It was a magnificent Shia. Look at it. On the receiving end, we were not attuned to his further, nor for spiritual growth. We breathed the air of English conservatism, stability and tradition. We had spent 1 or 2 years in various yeshivas and were motivated to study Torah and value prayer. But most of us aspired to become successful businessmen and professionals rather than prayer aficionados. Our dreams were directed more towards financial than spiritual riches. We were university undergraduates, spending many hours each day studying the theories of modern accounting, the legal judgments of Lord Denning, and the secular wisdom of modern economic and sociological prophets. We recognized the Rav's illustrious mentors, revered his scholarship, enjoyed and learned from his erudition, but for many years remained skeptical and suspicious of making any real changes in our lifestyles or ideals. I think that's very true. We were very skeptical of him at first. He was a very lively, very almost extreme. His Musa was very, very stark indeed, and we were skeptical of him. Yet each Sunday night, we returned to the front room of a Moshe Kuskal in Golders Green, and the world persevered to enlighten us. We were open-minded and determined enough to sit for several hours and gradually became enlightened. I think that's a milah, everyone. We were determined. We listened. Many of us came, were very skeptical. We've been in Keren Yavne together, and many of us were in Keren Yavne, all of us are grouped together. And we were skeptical, but at least we came along. We were determined to listen to something because he had something to say. Sorry?
That's very similar to the Rob Burns, Rabbi Burns.
Oh gosh, yeah. He had a 300.
Yeah. Let's carry on. Handcrafted scenes with penetrating insight. Each year was grounded in the classic works of the Rishonim and Menachem Reinim. His interpretations and insights into passages from the Midrash and the Chazal were piercing and often fascinating. His delivery was articulate, captivating, and complete with humor and true-to-life cartoons depicting human frailty in prayer. Famous historical scenes of prayer were vividly portrayed together with acute observations into every detail and description in Chazal. Let me give you some examples, some of the things which I remember. Beautiful Diyukim, he said, beautiful Diyukim. Listen to one or two of them, which I thought was so insightful, I can still remember them. In Pashas Vayera, look at some of these points which he brought, beautiful points which he would bring out. Pashas Vayera, when Avram is sitting there and the three Malachim come along. What word is missing here? He was sitting there at the gate of the tent. What word is missing? What? Vayokom. Doesn't say Vayokom. So Rabbi Avda said he did a flying leap. This man, 3 days from the chair, he was off from the chair. It doesn't say by Yochum, by Yah, by Yoritz, but he was sitting down. It doesn't say by Yah, by Yochum, by Yah, by Yoritz. Beautiful point, though. Mm-hmm. Inside to see the point, he flew off on the seat. He was beautiful. Diet, another diet which he made, which is a beautiful point as well. In the Haftarah, Parshas Vayera, I remember it very clearly about the Eishes Ovadia. To this deer, beautiful deer king he made. Remember the Maisa that the child had died, and then Elisha came to revive the child. You know the Maisa. So then she lay him on the bed, just a deer, which is a beautiful deer at the end. She laid the child on the bed, and Elisha came to revive the child. The pasuk at the end said as follows: and he breathed on the child. And the child was revived. The child came back to life. And he called to Gezi. Go and call the Isha Hushanamis. He told her, go and pick up your child. You know the mice. The child had died, and now Elisha now had revived the child. So Gehazi had to go and call the child. She came in, she fell on whose feet? Elisha's feet.
Yes.
Yeah. Elisha's feet. Right. Elisha's feet. Yeah. Yeah. He made a beautiful diak here. Where was the Isha? They had to go and call the woman? Where would the woman be? A woman has no child, has a child. The child dies. Where should she be? She's standing outside the door, no? She was gone somewhere. She wasn't there. She wasn't a nosy woman. She let him go his own. He had to go and call the woman to come into the womb. As soon as the woman saw the child was alive, she went and thanked him first. It's a beautiful diak here. Which woman? What woman first? My child is living. She first went and said thank you. Incredible woman, this woman. She first of all went and thanked Elisha, Batisa Esbena, and then she went to pick up a child and she went, beautiful diakim, no. See what type of woman she was. She wasn't standing and peeping through the keyhole. She wasn't doing that. She was there. She was gone somewhere to Davin, wherever she was. Then when she saw the child, she first of all went and thanked Elisha, and then she went to pick up the child. It's a beautiful diakim here. Beautiful diakim here. Those are the sort of diakim which Rabbi Bebler would make, which made a tremendous impression on me. I'll show you another one as well. In Megillas Esther, right at the very end of Megillas Esther, it's a wonderful deal. I think this is priceless. This is my brevda. I think it is one of his best comments. A deal. The end of the Megillah says as follows. After all that happened in Perek Tes, Esther said, Kisvulina Doiroi, she wrote to the Sanhedrin, please write me down. And the Pasuk says, Vayishlach Sforim es kol ha-Yehudim el sheva esu meyer medina medina achashverosh lekayim es yimei ha-poim ba-eile bizmaneim ashe kiyam aleyem mordchai ba-Yehudi ba-Esther Malka kashe kiyam es nevshom dibrei tzoymus v'zakosam. Esther wrote to the Sanhedrin, these are to be written down as days of fasting and crying. Umama Esther kiyam dibrei ha-poim ha-eile bet-nichtos. It was all written down and said, all that Esther had done. Next Pasuk. Last pasuk in Megillas Esther, last period. Vayosam ha-melech Achashverosh mas al ha-oretz yeh hayom. What effect did all this happen on Achashverosh from all that happened?
None.
Geld, no? Just money. Get the money back. I gave a hanocha now because of Esther. One thing, there was no Yisroi here, no? Yisroi heard about Kriyas Yamsu. Yisroi was affected by it. Yisroi. One thing Achashverosh was thinking, the only thing he was thinking about was money. And now I gave a hanocha because of beautiful deal, this no geld. Geld. The man was interested in their money. As far as Mordechai was concerned, ki Mordechai Hudi Mishne Lamech, Mordechai was a tzaddik. You see the comparison here, the contrast between two types of people. Achashverosh was only interested in money. I gave a hanocha and I want to get all the money back. That's all the thing is. No impression on him. Like water off a duck's back. Didn't make any impression on him. No impression. Incredible. Now, all that he'd seen the persecution. He knew about the Gezardin. He knew about Haman. He knew about all that happened with Mordechai. And in the end, just get my money back. Some people are never, ever affected by it. I was thinking just today about this. A person go through life and all he's interested in is money. Life is there for making money. Nothing ever changes in a person. Nothing ever moves him. That was the greatness of Yisro. Yisro had the highest position, one of the highest positions in the country, no? He was a Kohen, he was one of the advisors of power. And he heard something, it made an impression on him. He reacted positively, and he reacted spontaneously. He did something about it. Of Achashverosh, just guilt. It's a diak of Rabbe, a beautiful diak, I think. That's one of the points, which his insights were incredible insights. Let's have a look a little bit further. Drawing on phrases and nuances in the Medrash, his account of the Akedah brought you close enough to be emotionally moved by every cry and murmur in prayer from Avraham Avinu as he prepared to slaughter his son Yitzchak. He portrayed this. He had an unbelievable power of imagination, I bet. He would bring down the scene in front of you, like as if Avraham was in front of you, and you would see the scene in front of him. And the Medrash describes when Avraham lifted up the knife to shecht him, so he was crying and all the tears went down from his head and the Malachim called him out. He portrayed the scene in a beautiful, beautiful way. His portrayal was absolutely wonderful. I remember when we first came to Eretz Yisrael, we went to visit his mother. She lived in Mechavia, Rebbe's mother. She showed us pictures which he had drawn as a young man. And unbelievably artistic, all inside one scene was like pictures of a person and a scene. All inside us, he was capable of drawing a scene. He saw all the terms inside it, all the situations inside it. Look at the next one, which I describe here, about going out of Egypt, coming out of Egypt. Each episode in the survival and eventual fame of Yosef was grounded on his continuous prayer and not from his administrative ingenuity or outstanding good looks and charm. That was a beautiful point. He always brought out about Yosef. Yosef, all the things, hu hamashbir, hu hashalit, he had tremendous control over everything. Yet all the time you kept on seeing, Yosef was davening at each point. He brought that out all the time by prayer. He had such tremendous power, all the king's horses and all the king's men. He had all the power behind it. Nothing. All he had was dvekus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was the lesson which he brought out. Through vivid narrative and infinite detail, the Rav depicted every domestic scene as Bnei Yisrael prepared to leave Egypt. the trauma of national circumcision, tying a sheep to the bedpost for 4 days, and protecting it from being mauled by tens of children. Imagine the scene, slaughtering, roasting, and eating the sheep without breaking a bone. All the children running around, how do you possibly do that? Making sure no child left the house the night before the redemption, and visiting the Egyptian homes to collect their precious heirlooms and values. The finale in this memorable account was the portrayal of Paro running through the streets of Goshen in his pajamas, searching for Moshe and Aaron, and the bizarre contrast of the Jews singing Hallel in jubilant celebration while the Egyptians wailed over their dead firstborn. That's the scene, and he would portray all that. All those scenes, imagine children in the house looking after the Korban Pesach, and children pulling the lamb, mustn't make any mum on it, and collecting all the things needed for the Korban Pesach, the olive branch and the hyssop and everything which was needed for it. He would describe the scenes in a beautiful way. Each subplot in Megillas Esther was woven into an imaginative tapestry, tracing the Hashgacha Pratis, the divine providence, from one episode to the next. The Rav's primary objective was to illustrate the unique partnership in prayer between Mordechai and Esther. Mordechai's cries of prayer outside the king's harem aroused the people to the realization that they faced an impending Holocaust. Esther's request for national prayer rallies as she approached the throne room after 3 days of fasting became the pivot of salvation for the Jewish people. I don't know if you know that medrash. It's an incredible medrash. The Megillah does not bring this out. If you read the Megillah, Esther came in, and as soon as Esther comes in, so the king stretches out his scepter. But there's crucial passages which the medrash brings out here. When she saw the face of Ahasuerus, she collapsed. She collapsed on one of her maidens because she saw he was furious. He came in without permission at all. And my brother used to describe the scene. As Esther came closer, she saw him. She saw he was furious with her. She collapsed. The Medrash then said, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu had rachamim on this Yisoyma, who trusted in him, and he made a chutzal chesed. You know, I remember my brother, green is supposed to be, green is beautiful. No, not black is, but she looked green. Evidently, green was beautiful. She looked beautiful in the eyes of Achim. Incredible chesed. From all the tefillahs of what Esther had said, Ahasuerus found favor in her. That was the unbelievable. He brought out the koach of tefillah, which Esther said. The Shiurim during the month of Elul, in preparation for Rosh Hashanah and the 10 days of repentance, stirred even the blithest Englishman. In practical terms, the Rav imparted an invaluable awareness and sensitivity to the content and intention behind each prayer, enabling us to avoid the pressing pitfalls of a wandering mind. He was brilliant at that. You know, people get distracted when it comes to davening Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but he kept you on hand. I remember he gave a Gemara Shir every week as well. Besides the Sunday night shmooze, there was a Gemara Shir. Always we prepared before Yom Tov, the halachas, Shulchan Aruch, Tur Shulchan Aruch, preparing for the Yom Tov, Hanukkah and Pesach and Sukkot, all the halachas we went through the halachas beforehand. The Shirim for Hanukkah swept aside the secular emphasis on the military valor of the Hashmonaim. He replaced this bogus ideology with an authentic celebration of Hallel and Hoidor. Praise and thanks to the Almighty for the miraculous victories over the Greek forces. He continually stressed the urgency of prayer as we faced important decisions or were challenged by personal difficulties.
Can I ask how did he?
Whenever
what person, tips did he give you to,
for example, on Shidduchim, some of us had problems with our parents, whatever difficult situations which we went through, problems on Shidduchim, problems with Shalom Bayis, always the kibbun was the kibbun of prayer. As he always used to bring that out, always koach of tefillah, to daven, especially used to say always on the lashon of in estem kivishuoscha kivinu kol hayoyim. So the Shulchan Aruch brings down, is a perush, and I think it's brought in the Be'er Heitev, the Ma'arit said it brings down. When you say the words Kivi Shuasa, Kivinu Kol Hayom, you should think of the Nisyonos that you're going through the following day. Kivi Shuasa, I trust in your Yeshua on this particular time. And it's brought down, when you say those words every day in Es Tzemach Dovid, to think of what you're going through the following day. He used to give us that Eitzos and Davening at the end of Shemoneh Esrei to make a bakosha at the end where you put your pasuk, these sort of eitzes which you said. Shidduchim especially, issues of Shalom Bayis, different things like that. I remember I once went to him for about a certain shidduch, and he turned around to me and said to me, yes, if you want to throw plates at each other, then it's a good eitzah. If you want to marry your mum and throw plates at her, that would be good for you to marry. Throwing plates at each other, that would be the best thing in marriage. You want to spend your marriage throwing plates at each other. He had incredible insight into certain people, you know. Unbelievable humor he had. He could be very, very sharp, very sharp. He would never ever say anything to us in anything external. We all always had we didn't dress like yeshiva bachurim at all. We had, some of us had longer hair or some, never mentioned anything chitzonius, nothing at all. Look at this section at the end, maybe I'll tell you this at the end, which is beautiful. Look at this at the end, which I thought was very impressive. Look at this section, look at taste, look at page 60, taste the fruit, not the peel. In this davening, just this point as we're mentioning it now. This change in our perspective in prayer was not measured by decibels or length. The davening was not particularly loud, nor was particularly long, but perfect timing compared with a lively rhythm and an upbeat tone. He was very important. It should be spirited. The davening should be alive. He didn't want the davening to be dragged out too much, nor too loud, but just spirited. When the prophets of Baal failed to bring down fire from heaven to consume their sacrifice on Mount Carmel, Eliyahu mocked them by suggesting they call out louder. A Baal may be sleeping. There are times when Chazal advise hearing one voice in prayer and an aid to devotion. But we learn from Hannah that the Almighty heard every syllable of her whispered prayer. Prayer need not be loud. Prayer in the minyan was audible and distinct, but never deafening. No screaming. You could hear the Rav's precise articulation, but it never interfered or disturbed your own prayers. Over a period of 40 years, I never heard him discuss or mention any external pious trimmings in prayer, such as raising one's voice, standing for long periods of time, shackling, choice of clothing, or taking longer over any prayer. On the contrary, I recall numerous occasions when he would pressure us to pray faster and avoid arriving late for work or college. His focus was steadfastly set on our tasting the essential fruit of prayer, the connection with the Almighty, and not the peel, any external trappings. I imagine he was concerned that we may find more nourishment from the peel instead of tasting the actual fruit. Isn't that true, though? So people get involved in shackling and davening and screaming. Oh, that's the peel, isn't it, David? It's not. Yeah. It's not the fruit. The fruit is the davening. The davening. Ken. He was against all that. He was against anything which made an exhibition. There was no exhibition. The davening was directly focused to the point. You know, that's directly bullseye. It wasn't an issue of raising your voice too loud or anything like that. I remember just as a point for my, he wasn't interested in any external trappings. I remember I used to come very often in the winter with a camel coat, a light camel coat, like the sweater, a light colored coat. So it's not very yeshivish, no. So I remember he turned around to me once, I was getting in the car with him. He says, "You understand, next time you buy a coat, a little bit darker." A little bit. Nothing, but he wasn't interested in that. Not to look yeshivish or anything. We were university undergraduates or something. And that was ingenious. He never, ever mentioned anything about going to learn in yeshiva. None of us. He mentioned the importance of Torah, that's all. All the people, I was a lawyer, and my friend was an accountant, one was a socialist, one was an economist, one was an actuary. He never mentioned it. The importance was to get the point. Once you get the point, you make your own decision about it. He never meant. I thought it was very clever.
Did other bathrooms go on to do into learning like you did, or?
Oh, there must be about 20 of us. About 20.
Oh.
You're from Los Angeles. You're from Los Angeles. By Graven, yeah, Baruch Hu and Graven. You know, Fishman in Torah Moshe. I found a Fishman was there. He was at university in London. There's about 20 of us. There's about 15 in Israel and about five in America. Yeah, so many of us did. Many of us came into learning. But he never mentioned that. Never mentioned about going to learn when you get married. It was all a personal decision that you made. I thought it was very clever. It's up to you. Just the Hashivas of Torah, that was the point as well.
Leading by example.
But leaving it up to you. Leaving it up to you. I thought that was very healthy. Never to push anything at all.
We had Diane Lopier, Gershon Lopier, looking after he was our father, basically. We were his family, by extension. Beautiful.
Let me tell you, the first time I met Rav Brevda, my father had gone to Yalkei Kala in Gateshead, and he met him there. And I was in Toronto at the time. I did in university a business course. So I'd gone for 9 months to work to Reichmann in Toronto. I lived there for 9 months. When I came back to London, to England, to Birmingham, so my father said, he'd met Rabbi Brevda. He said, "It's good for you to go down and maybe have a talk to him." We live in Birmingham, which is about an hour and a half drive away from London. So he took me, my father gave me the cards, "Go down and talk to Rabbi Brevda." So I went into the house, and he was sitting in the back room, and he was learning. So I went inside there and I sat here. You're Reb Rebbe and I'm sitting here. So I'm Reb Rebbe, you're me, I'm sitting there. So the Rebbe comes in and gave me, put in front of me a coffee and cake, put it on the table in front of me. So I left it alone. I was embarrassed to start making a bracha. I just left it on the table. So I'm Reb Rebbe. Reb Rebbe picked up the chair and just looked out the window and was talking to himself, straight on. So everything I was saying, he was taking no notice of me. So he's taking no notice of me. I'll have the coffee and cake. Taking no notice of me. After I finished made the bracha, then he picked his chair up and carried on talking to me. So it was a very special way of doing it. He saw I was embarrassed. He'd tell me to drink something. I didn't want to. And every time I said anything to him, he'd take no notice of me. Just talking to the window. Talking about someone called Gestetner. You know the Gestetner in Toronto? Yeah, yeah. They worked for Toronto and Moshe Weichmann, he was talking about. But he had no... He didn't want to embarrass me. I could see. I thought it was such a clever way of doing it. And then turned around.
Is that somebody that you learned with?
I think so. Aaron Gestetner, who worked for Weichmann. Yes. Yeah.
I knew Gestetner.
I was in one young place. It was. That's where we went to.
There was
to,
a Gestetner in Manhattan also.
Yeah.
Had a business in Manhattan.
Let's go to something of the davening here. Let me show you something of the davening, which I think was... Or maybe the next one. Maybe the next section is very nice as well. Look at this next one. Look at page 51. Pinpointing the Rav's achievement in regard to prayer. Page 51. Lech lecha me'atzecha.
How long was he in England before?
Sorry?
How long was he there for?
In England?
Yeah.
He was there for about 12 years.
12 years.
About 12 years, yes. Oh. About 12 years. He lived in Craven Walk. Next to Jackie Levinson he lived on. You know Craven Walk? You know, opposite Diane Dunner there. He was in London. He was in London for about 12 years. And then he came to Eretz Yisrael. He lived across the road from the Stipler in Eretz Yisrael. An apartment on the Chav HaShabbam across the road from the Stipler. Look at this next point here.
He was in Eretz Yisrael for the rest.
Then he was in America for a while, and then he came back to Eretz Yisrael as well. Pinpointing the Rav's achievement in regard to prayer, he initiated a radical change in perspective from converting this daily ritual into the most privileged of all conversations. Before listening to his shiurim, I regarded prayer as an obligatory recital that needed not take too long. Born, bred, and educated in the Septet Isle, my prayer was ingrained with English custom and propriety. I respected the sanctity of the synagogue and enjoyed the good communal sing-song with a lively tune, yet any overt display of fervor bordered on religious fanaticism. That's how I was. After years of enlightened and informative shiurim, we slowly began to realize that prayer is a unique activity that stands at the height of the world and people abuse its significance. Reb Simcha Zissel Boyder, the Alter from Kelm, explained that the phrase "the heights of the world" refers to the heights of man, who is a microcosm of the world at large. Looking back over those years, my assessment is that Brevda challenged us in the same vein as the Almighty tested Avraham. Leave your land, your birthplace, to the land that I will show you. The Rav groomed and readjusted our native focus. He educated us to recognize that prayer is not merely a religious ritual, but a conversation from the heart that raises a person's spiritual perspective way above his mundane daily routine. It's a beautiful, I think it's beautifully put here, if you don't mind me saying. He guided us to recognize that talking to the Almighty is the most exclusive privileged conversation. The Rav was the grand master at sharp one-liners to get his point across. He once asked, how can you fill a stadium with 100,000 people for Siyam HaShas, yet scratch around maybe 100 people to arouse an importance for prayer? You hear the point? Because the former requires physical agility at turning pages, while the latter demands depth of introspection, a rare commodity in our times. Isn't that true, though? Mm-hmm. Learning Shas, you have to turn the pages around. Oh, but davening with Kavana is introspection. It's a rare commodity. The Rav was a teacher par excellence. Despite his foreign background, breeding, and culture, he instinctively recognized the strengths and weaknesses of each member of the minyan. To my knowledge, the Rav never asked a Talmud to aspire to more than he could realistically attain. And it was very clever as well. Not to ask you to do something which was beyond you. I don't think that's true. I remember I used to go jogging very often. You know, but I found it very helpful. So I once turned around to him and said to him, you know, maybe I shouldn't waste my time jogging. He said, I never told you to stop jogging. Keep on jogging. He said, why not? Keep on, what's wrong with you? He knew I needed sport. I need to run around a lot. And I thought, he said, why not? Who else said anything about What's wrong with jogging? What's wrong? You know, people need certain things. People need certain things. It certainly helped that he was an accomplished Talmud Chacham and uniquely able to portray a scene from Chazal with vivid imagery. But I do not believe that they were the root causes of his success. Chazal teach that words spoken from the heart penetrate the heart. He was totally convinced of the truth of what he taught and thoroughly committed to our spiritual growth. As a result, the Almighty granted him wisdom, perception, and extraordinary success. Let me read something. I wanted, because we're doing on tefillah, I wanted to show you something about... Oh, this is you'll like this next section here. Although educated and groomed into school of Brisk, where each mitzvah is embellished by the rigidity and stringency of each detail in halacha, the world was unconventional and often highly original in its assessment of lifetime scenarios by using the prism of Torah and mitzvahs. His insights, comments, and advice were incisive and frequently totally unpredictable. Above all, he shunned making value judgment based on social convention. You could walk away headstrong that you knew better, but all too often you were forced to admit that his foresight and field of vision was broader and deeper than your own. Reb David Fox described this as an ability to reveal the complexities of a deceptively simple world. He would find something complex when you thought it was simple. His comprehension of world events was uncanny and often enlightening. His recognition and unlimited support for a genuine tzaddik realigned our own focus. It was fine-tuned to the needs of each Talmud and carefully guided each shidduch to completion. He drew close and warmly encouraged those who sincerely wanted to grow in Torah and mitzvahs, regardless of their age, origins, background, financial resources, or academic abilities. Let me explain to you. My father, Olav Ashon, was very close to him. I think they spoke on the phone every single week. I think he spoke every single week. My father was not a great Talmud Chacham, nor was he a gevir, but he saw in my father tremendous avas ha-Torah. And I think that's why they were so close. My father hadn't learned in yeshiva. He used to learn every evening, my father, the Silverman's Chumash, Rashi, and Blackman's Mishnayos. My father had tremendous avas ha-Torah. He saw that in him. I was amazed at the connection he had with my father. He was a Talmud Chacham, and my father wasn't a wealthy man. He wasn't getting money from my father. And also, he wasn't a great learner, but he saw his avas ha-Torah. I think out of all the parents, my father was the closest of all to him, of all the parents of the Talmud. Someone had a bakosha p'torah, a cheshev p'torah, he picked up that person and stayed close with him. A not so young Chosson and Kala were each determined after marriage to settle in their separate native communities. Although confident that he had the prerogative to choose where to live, the Chosson agreed to follow the counsel of the Rav. He was astonished when the Rav advised them to settle in the Kala's community. The Rav reasoned that it would be too difficult for a lady of her age to make friends in a new environment. Clever, no? While the Chosson could quickly adapt through contacts in the synagogue. Beautiful idea that, no? The Chosson would be easier, but the Chosson can make contacts in shul. But the Kala, where will the Kala find? Years later, the Chosson recognized the accuracy and wisdom behind the Rav's decision. Although due to the influence of his view, many Talmidim left their professional careers and became full-time learners in Kollel, to the best of my knowledge, the Rav never directly instigated such a move. He wisely stepped back and left this decision in the hands of each family and then did all he could to support their chosen lifestyle. It was a very clever thing to do. Very clever thing to do. Maybe we'll talk about the tefillah. How much time do we have left? Is it time up already?
Six minutes.
Let's just read a little bit more. Page 34. Many who were unable to attend the shiur were perplexed over his eventually zealous enthusiasm for prayer. I will attempt to clarify this bewilderment by explaining the criteria and rudiments of the minyan that evolved in later years. Let's just look at the next section. Initially, the Sunday night shiur was a forum where the Rav taught and illustrated, among other themes, the essential mechanism and tools for prayer. The minyan, which was an offshoot of these shiurim, became a dynamic workshop for channeling these concepts into a daily code of practice. He would talk about the Sunday night aspects of prayer. Then the next morning in davening, you would come to his house and you would see it practiced. For example, Somer Gula L'Tfila. He would talk about the importance of singing and davening, the importance of diuk, and you then heard him davening the next morning. So everything which you heard in the shiur was really applied the next morning, which was a beautiful, it was a perfect educational setting where the ideals and theory of prayer were maneuvered into a daily application. Fundamental concepts expanded in the shiur resonated in the prayers next morning during the coming weeks. Each line in the siddur offers tuition and guidance in the cardinal principles of Emunah and Bitachon. Yet a persistent hazard in prayer is trying to ensure that these principles do not fade into extinction. Isn't that true, Rabbi Isai? Or to the best unconsciousness, due to regularity and routine. While the Shia offered a wake-up call with depth of understanding and inspiration, the Minyan rejuvenated each passage into meaningful lines of prayer. I'll give you some examples. Let's take page 57. All these are beautiful examples here. Page 57. He had a nusach in tefillah, Rabbi Sefer Davening. He had a nusach, right? Every hallelujah would always begin hallelujah, and then the end they go hallelujah, and you begin the new part hallelujah. It was always as a nusach. Va'ani bechastecho botachti yogalibi bishuosecho. Oshiro Lashem Kigomal Oloi. That was the nusach, which everybody sang it together in the meeting. It was very, very moving. On many occasions, the Shia delved into the theory and practice of Bitochen, trusting Hashem in everyday scenes. The Rav drew practical lessons from Chazal, in particular from his erudition in the writings of Vilna Gaon. David HaMelech writes, "Vani b'chastach ha-batachti, I trusted in your kindness, my heart rejoicing in your salvation. Number three, I will sing to Hashem for he has dealt kindly with me." Three stages, before, during, and after. The Gaon explained that the three phrases in this verse highlight three stages in Bitochen, before, during, and after any lifetime challenge. Devotion in prayer is the most eloquent expression of this Bitochen. Since most of us at the time were occupied with Shiduchim, searching for a suitable life partner, the three-pronged message was unequivocal. Before, one is supposed to pray success in deciding to not. You daven for a shidduch. And as I remember, I went to him many times. He used to say to me, the Shlo used to say, when you daven for a shidduch, you ask for Tovah Labriyas v'Tovah LaShamayim. That's it. When you ask for Tovah LaShamayim v'Tovah LaShamayim. I once asked Rav Naftali Kaplan, what do you look for in a kala? What do you look for, sorry, in a chosin? What do you look for? So I asked Rav Tali told me that he asked the same question to Rav Shach. Rav Shach told him, when you look for a chosin, you look for three things. Number one is a masmid. Number two, Yerushamayim. And number three is Yerushamayim. Yerushamayim, Midas Tovas. Three things you look for when you're looking for a chosin, your daughter. Number one is Midas. Yerushamayim is Dikduk in Halach. A masmid is he's careful about his learning. And Midas Tovas. So those are the three things which you look for. Number two, during the uppermost in the mind of a chosin and kala should be a prayer that the marriage should succeed. After settling down to married life, prayers are supposed to be called and give thanks to the Almighty for the gift of finding a lifetime partner. Clearly, the same three-point formula applies to investing in a new business venture, finding a suitable home, searching for employment or schooling for children, hiring a reliable surgeon, lawyer or accountant, buying a car and every other lifetime. The Gaon explains that the most neglected of all three stages is last. People don't remember. You don't recall things. You forget. Everybody davens before. Everybody davens while. Now, everybody davens for a shidduch beforehand. Everybody davens with time. But after you recall 10 years later, 20 years later, how often is the recall? Do you remember something? Oshio Lashem Gigamala is the hardest of all. To recall how something worked out. Prayer and before during a challenge is almost impulsive. After a while, recognition of having overcome a milestone is chalked up to the laws of nature and the rewards of prayer. And bitochen are summarily dismissed. So true that, no? It's always very true. You forget something. You forget how you got through an Nisayim. Okay, I'll leave you here, Rabbi Yisrael. These are my points. Thank you. Ideas.